Chinese muscle flexing in Hong Kong, with the new security law being applied in claimed contravention of Hong Kong's basic law, which should still apply till 2047. James Griffiths is an experienced foreign correspondent and writer. James lives in Hong Kong and he's reported for CNN, The Atlantic and the South China Morning Post across Asia. He's the author of several books, including The Great Firewall of China, How to Build and Control an Alternative Version of the Internet. Good morning, James.
Good morning.
Nice to talk to you. Thank you. A new security, national security office officially opened in Hong Kong. Mainland Chinese agents in the heart of your territory for the first time. What are we seeing so far from this move, James? Just generally first, please.
The biggest effect of the security law since it was passed on July 1st and has gradually been implemented, there has been quite a chilling effect in a variety of means across the city. You know, we've seen people deleting social media profiles, cleaning their profiles. We've seen various political parties have disbanded, and we've seen lots of shops and restaurants that were previously kind of very prominent supporting anti-government protests. They've been removing paraphernalia, removing posters and stickers and things like that. And then most significantly, we also saw on Friday night, the police raided a very prominent polling company in Hong Kong that was involved in hosting a primary for the Democratic candidates in the upcoming legislative elections in September. And that comes after there was a suggestion by the government that the primary itself could be against the national security law, though they were quite unclear just how that could be the case.
So security agents from the mainland for the first time being able to investigate people for a wide range of crimes defined by the new law and extradite them, James, to the mainland for trial?
Yes, that does seem to be the case. The laws people will be prosecuted then will be the much more broad and with more heavy punishments as we see in the mainland rather than the new ones in Hong Kong.
So the proof of the pudding will be what kinds of crimes in the end are prosecuted and whether they relate specifically to insurrection. I suppose that's what people are wondering about.
Not only what kind of crimes are prosecuted, but also how broadly the offences are, you know, how regularly we see prosecutions. You know, the government in the lead up to this has always said that this would be a very, very limited law, that it would only apply to a tiny handful of individuals, that most Hong Kongers would not find their lives affected by it, or whether the national security law is applied generally and broadly to criminalise a whole swath of behaviour. And, you know, the signs so far are not particularly positive, given that a large number of people were arrested at a recent protest on national security grounds. There have been several arrests since then related to those protests. And, you know, we are seeing a kind of lot of rhetoric, both from the government in Hong Kong and kind of Chinese state media, Chinese officials, about various behaviour being against national security. And so it does seem to be being applied in a kind of much more broad sense than the government first suggested.
And a broad question following on from that, whether you can put the genie of self-determination and freedom of expression back in the bottle, because China's opponents are saying this is what's at stake here.
Yeah, it will be very interesting to see just how much resistance there is to the law, how people try to work around it so that they can still continue to exercise their freedom of speech and, you know, freedom of expression, which the government, again, has said that they will continue to respect within the boundaries of the new law. And we've seen people, you know, trying to get around recent bans on certain phrases, certain protest slogans by kind of remixing them and you know, using symbols instead of words and things like that. But the model that the government seems to be following is the Chinese model, and that is not a particularly encouraging one for anyone that hopes to see, you know, vibrant free expression political speech in Hong Kong.
It may have come as a shock to people in the countries most vociferously opposing what China has done that there are only 27 of these countries, including New Zealand. 53 countries backed Beijing's new national security law for Hong Kong. And I know many of them will be beholden to China. But James, is it a bit of a stark reminder of how the world may be changing? What do you think?
Yes, I think it's you know, it's definitely indicative of just how much influence China has in the national community. And also, you know, how kind of on the face of it convincing maybe their cases that you know, this is a national security issue, that every country has national security laws and that this should be, you know, no issue. And of course, the problems with the law lie in how it may be executed and the kind of lack of various safeguards for it, not in the kind of overall concept of the law. Obviously, you know, as China points out, various countries, including the US, the UK, most critics of China do have national security laws, but they also have independent judiciaries and human rights protections. And so, unfortunately, for critics of the law in Hong Kong, China has been able to make a decently convincing case at an international level, and then has found lots and lots of allies to bolster it.
Yes, but in those 27 countries which aren't in support of it, I imagine democracy might look small globally now. It doesn't sound like a big number, 27.
No, and we do seem to be, again, heading towards something of a bipolar international system. There definitely is a kind of growing division between democratic, for lack of a better term, countries on one side and countries led by China, Russia to a lesser extent on the other side. And, you know, unfortunately, China's model of authoritarianism and you know, effective economic and political control, I think that might look quite attractive to a lot of leaders around the world who are, you know, quite skeptical of what greater democracy and loosening restrictions might cause for their grip on power. And they can look to China and say, well, you know, here is a party that has managed to maintain a very, very firm grip on its country for 70 plus years, while also becoming the second largest economy in the world and a global superpower.
Yeah. The reviewing of relationships with Hong Kong by the Five Eyes countries, can you see this reviewing having much effect?
Beijing has hit out against that very, very aggressively, as we might expect. And certainly, you know, I think this will deepen divide between Five Eyes countries and Beijing. And this was a kind of, there was something of a split in Five Eyes, but previously in that New Zealand and Australia especially were relatively close to China and were you know, happy to try and build that relationship, certainly compared to the US. And so this would seem to be ending, you know, certainly if New Zealand follows Australia's lead, that would be seeming to end much of a, you know, positive relationship between the Five Eyes countries and Beijing. Whether Hong Kong will be a blip in these relationships and ultimately won't be deemed worthwhile to sever the especially economic relations with China, or if Hong Kong is the beginning of a you know, more marked shift away from China.
Yeah, and this is an interesting tightrope for Australia and New Zealand and Canada, I suppose, to walk along. New Zealand essentially being told to mind its own business. In the case of New Zealand, we use stern enough words to satisfy our Five Eyes partners, but not so stern that we imperil trade with China. Is that cynical view, in fact, how it works right now?
You know, I think you could argue that most countries and most members of Five Eyes, maybe except the US, all pretty much do the same thing. The UK has also long walked a tightrope with China. You know, they now seem to be again cracking down on Huawei after indicating that they might not in the past. So I don't think New Zealand would be alone in, you know, speaking a good game and not necessarily following up. Mm. You know, I think maybe this is an instance. Hong Kong is an issue where there might be more public pressure for action. I think possibly more than there ever was on things like Huawei and you know, certain security relationships. You know, people in these countries are broadly sympathetic to the fate of people in Hong Kong, and you know, I think a lot of especially people in, you know, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK have something of a connection to Hong Kong, feel a degree of familiarity with it. And that does make it more of a broader political issue within these countries.
Extradition arrangements are one thing, but can countries like New Zealand afford to look at exports of strategic goods to Hong Kong without incurring the more severe displeasure of China? There's so far you can go. That's what you seem to be implying.
Yes, there may be only so far you can go. And I think it will be. Hong Kong ultimately is a city of 7 million people. It is a pretty small economy in the grand scheme of things, and whether countries are willing to sever ties, not just with Hong Kong, but effectively with China, with the second largest economy in the world, that is a much bigger question.
Yeah. Australia's offered a pathway to residency for 10,000 Hong Kongers on student and temporary visas. Beijing doesn't like that. And will it permit tens of thousands of Hong Kong people, James, to emigrate to the UK, for example? Or will it to rid the city of inconvenient elements? What's going to happen there?
I think we should be maybe slightly sceptical about just how many Hong Kongers would want to move to the UK, especially as the country is struggling with the coronavirus at the moment. And also, you know, people are very attached to living in the city. I think people, you know, want to remain here for as long as possible. Whether or not China could do anything to prevent people leaving would, I think, be somewhat difficult, because certainly, obviously, people could leave on Hong Kong passports and then declare British national overseas status once they arrive in the UK. And maybe they would be happy to kind of rid the city of their people who you know, are not, don't desire to live in it under Chinese rule.
Yeah.
We'll have to see.
Yeah. The other thing we'll have to see is up your alley in terms of expertise. I think it's been said that China's great firewall will come down as being applied to Hong Kong now. Do you think that's right? I imagine it would take time, but is that going to happen?
Yeah, so on Monday, the Hong Kong government, under its new powers under the security law, gave massive new powers to the police to both censor and order internet service providers and internet companies based in the city to hand over data. And, you know, this was pretty quickly greeted by multiple big tech companies, you know, Microsoft, Facebook, Google, all announced that they would be suspending data sharing with Hong Kong authorities. They seem to be gearing up for a potential showdown here over both censorship and data sharing. And the real question, and I don't think it's necessarily one that the Hong Kong government is particularly prepared for, is what happens when you go to Facebook and you say, we demand that you delete this page, that you, you know, take it off the internet, and Facebook says no. Are they then going to block that page for users in Hong Kong? Are they going to block Facebook entirely? How do they do that? What do they do if people are using VPNs and other ways to get around that block? Those kind of questions very quickly lead to installing much more of a kind of sophisticated censorship apparatus, which obviously China has ready to go out of the box across the border in the Great Firewall.
And this would be a clear indication of Chinese intentions, wouldn't it? Because the digital space was used so effectively during the protests that you would think you can't impose control of an important area of discourses beyond your control.
Yeah, it would definitely be a very concerning sign of intentions. And it would also be, I think it would be a very alienating and very kind of potentially radicalizing step for a lot of Hong Kongers who are kind of maybe not fans of either the protests or of Beijing, but do prize the city's freedoms and relative autonomy compared to China. And, you know, the internet obviously is one of those major, major differences between, you know, you step across the border from Shenzhen into Hong Kong and suddenly you have a wealth of information available to you that wasn't previously. And so were the Great Firewall to come up around Hong Kong, that would be just a colossal transformation in how the city operates, not just in terms of protests, but also just kind of generally people's own social networking and messaging with their friends and family. You know, that would be a huge transformation.
James Griffiths has been talking to us again. So just finally, the end of common law, the end of Hong Kong, as it's being portrayed, a bit too early to say still.
Yeah, a bit too early to say. It will really remain, you know, I think uncertain for months to come. I think until we get the first prosecutions, the first convictions under this law, and then we should also probably have an idea then of just how widely and how broadly these offences are being applied. Certainly, the signs so far are not positive.
Good to talk with you, James. Thanks very much for your time again.
Thank you.
James Griffiths.